Well, we are, we are starting the series this week, The Joneses. We're taking a look at this strange world of comparison that we've fallen into, and the way it influences our choices down to our relationships and the quality of life in ways that we often don't even really connect the dots on. And I think that it's hard for us to really dig down and understand what's bubbling underneath this constant comparison thing. Because it's just the very air that we breathe. It is our environment swirling around us, and sometimes it's very hard to identify something when you're right in the thick, in the middle of it. So I thought what we'd do is maybe kick off the series just by kind of rising up over the treetops a little bit and just taking a look at the lay of the land of the way this world that's swirling around us that we're all very much a part of has gotten us when it comes to this thing of the Joneses. So I thought we'd do a little fill-in-the-blank game, I've created for this weekend, and I call it Something's Wrong. Okay, this game's called Something Wrong. So if you would, we just want to kind of test your trivial knowledge here a little bit, just on a few statistics here. So just see if you can fill in the blank on this stuff. Today, we know that the average new home built in the United States is a little bit over 2,400 square feet. In 1950, the average new home built was how big? How big? Anybody have an idea? That was 963. 900. In the last 50 years, the average square footage of the homes that we live in, that we're building and living in, have increased by 250%. 250% at the same time our average family size has been going down. It's been going down. Now, at the same time our homes have been increasing by 250%, and they haven't quite been big enough to hold all our stuff. So at the same time, you know, during this rough period that our home sizes have increased by 250%, at the same time, we have X amount, times the amount of commercial self-storage facilities in the U.S. Anybody have an idea? How many times the amount? 25 times. At the same time our homes have increased by 250%, our self-storage facilities outside the home have increased by 2,500% to hold all the stuff we can't fit in our 2.5 size homes. A result of a lot of this is that as U.S. consumers, we spend more on a certain part of our budget. As U.S. consumers, we spend more on this part of our budget than the individual gross national product of 40% of the countries of the world. The individual gross national product of 40% of the countries of the world, what part of our budget do you think that is? Food, entertainment. No, actually, it's garbage bags. Garbage bags. As U.S. consumers, we spend more on garbage bags every year than the individual GNP of 40% of the nations of the world. And you know what? We spend more on eating out every year than the individual gross national product of 95% of the countries in the world. Something's wrong. And it's reflected in our diets, too. It's reflected in, you know, the choices that we're making and our portion sizes. Today, when we go and order a muffin, we have a muffin. The average muffin that we eat is 5 ounces and 500 calories. Anyone guess just 20 years ago, 1985, just 20 years ago, how big the muffins were we were eating? Two and a half. Actually, 1.5 ounces. 1.5. When we said we were eating a muffin, when we said I ate a muffin for breakfast 20 years ago, we had consumed 210 calories. When we say I had a muffin for breakfast today, we've had 500 calories. 500 calories. And we're passing this on. We're passing these kind of things on to our, you know, future generations. Surveys say that 93% of teenage girls rate what as their favorite activity? Shopping, yes. And we all know that. We all know that. How do we, I thought it was going to be like talking on the phone, you know, or something, or shopping. And the result of all this, the choices that we're making, is that there's a certain activity that we engage in every year that more Americans do now every year than graduate from college or get divorced. Anybody know what that fun activity is? Declare personal bankruptcy. More Americans declare personal bankruptcy every year than graduate from college or get divorced. Now, this is my favorite one, because you would think that, you know, college students, that's the time in your life when you're most kind of strapped for cash, right? That's when you have the least available resources to you. So when you think about it, on a whole, U.S. college students as a whole, how much do you think they spend on alcohol every year? This is total for all of the U.S. $5.5 billion. $5.5 billion. Leaders of tomorrow. Right there. You know what? And we've produced that. You know, but I think you do. You have to take this seriously. You have to say, you know what? We love to say that we're really serious about ending hunger in this world, and yet our college students alone are spending $5.5 billion just on alcohol every year. I think we have to question this world that we've kind of spiraled into. And the result of all this, the result of all this is that in just the last 50 years, what do you think fits in this blank? In the last 50 years, U.S. consumers have used up more resources than, okay, maybe all of Europe or maybe all of the Western Hemisphere. Everyone who ever lived anywhere on the planet before us. The sum total of anyone who lived anywhere in the world for the entire history of the planet, we've consumed more resources than them just in the last 50 years. And you know, if those statistics aren't enough to kind of shock you back to a little recalibration, you know what the kicker in this whole thing is? It's not working. It's not working. All the studies show that in the last 50 years, in the last 30 years, in the last 20 years, all the lines are going up. Average square footage of houses, average number of cars, average real income, inflation adjusted average real income, we have a lot more money than our parents do to spend. And it doesn't feel like it, does it? We do. Average real income, average size of houses, average amount spent on entertainment, average amount we travel, all of them trending up, except for there's always one line in all these studies that's totally flat and hasn't been changed. Happiness. Happiness. Studies are all showing that this stuff isn't doing anything to increase the percentage of people who say they're happy or that they are content or that they're satisfied. So much so that Time, earlier this year, devoted an entire issue to this. Such a shocking revelation to our world. They devoted an entire issue to this. It's called The Science of Happiness. And one of the things they found there is that they're finding that increased ability to consume and increased financial resources apparently have no impact on whether people are happy or not. And that people who have more, no higher percentage of them say they're happy than people who have less. And people who had less and now have more, their happiness level hasn't changed either. So much so, there's an economics professor at Cornell who wrote a book about this. And this is how he talks about it in Luxury Fever. He said, a host of careful studies suggest that across-the-board increases in our stocks of material goods produce virtually no measurable gains in our psychological or physical well-being. Bigger houses and faster cars, it seems, don't make us any happier. Now, that's the kind of thing you would expect to hear from a church, right? I don't know that you'd expect to hear that from a professor of economics at Cornell. And this has become, you know, kind of such shocking revelations to our world to start to challenge, oh my goodness, maybe this stuff isn't making us happier. And I don't know quite why it's such a countercultural notion, but it is. But for years and years and years and centuries, philosophers have been telling them this. But we always kind of, you know, kind of chalked it up to, oh, well, that's some nice sentiment that dudes that used to walk around in robes and sandals have. But they don't understand the realities of today. You know, they don't know exactly how much contentment and fulfillment and joy that a video iPod can bring someone. You know, they didn't understand these things. When you go all the way back, to the Apostle Paul, who a lot of his letters to churches and communities that he was mentoring have been captured within the New Testament of our Bible as different epistles. And there's this one place where he's talking about this to this community in Philippi that he writes. And it's collected in our Bible as Philippians 4. And take a look at how he talks about contentment here. Paul says, I've learned to be content whatever the circumstances. I know what it is to be in need, and I know what it is to have plenty. I've learned the secret of being content in any and every situation, whether well-fed or hungry, whether living in plenty or in want. And we see here the message that Paul is sending thousands of years ago, the message that he's sending is that contentment, now get ready, this is the countercultural part, that the minute I say this, you'll think about just how, start thinking about how it's absolutely, well, actually not true, but it really, really is. Contentment is not conditional. Contentment is absolutely not conditional. Contentment has absolutely nothing to do with how much you have versus that you used to have. Contentment has absolutely nothing to do with how much you have versus those around you. Even though that's so countercultural for us because that's the very definition of contentment that we've come to. But the statistics and these surveys that are coming out are becoming so clear, it's shocking us. It's shocking us so much so that there's been a new term developed to kind of analyze this. It's been called hedonic adaptation. Hedonic from the word hedonism, pursuit of pleasure. And the fact that people so quickly, they think something's going to bring them more happiness, that they get it and they get a very, very short-term buzz. And then they immediately go right back down to the level of pleasure or displeasure that they were. They immediately adapt to it. The hedonic adaptation, or what's been called the hedonic treadmill. And the fact is that increasingly we become in the society very much like a junkie getting our fix. That the, even the greater problem is not only do we immediately go back to the level of happiness that we were, but it takes a bigger buzz the next time to get us that spike. And then we immediately go right back. And then why is this? Why is this? It's because contentment is not conditional, and we have fallen for this lie that it is. And it's created the kind of society that we have, kind of society where we consume more in 50 years than everybody anywhere else on the planet in the entire time before us. It's become the kind of place where we spend that much on trash bags every year. It's become the kind of place that we are defined as a country. We used to be defined by what we produce. We are now defined in our identity as by what we consume. So much so that when Mother Teresa visited the United States, and you know, y'all, Mother Teresa, she served among the poorest of the poor in the slums of Calcutta. And when she visited the United States, this was her observation. She said, "This is the poorest place I've ever been." And you know, she wasn't talking about availability of clean drinking water. You know, she wasn't talking about, oh, what percentage of people live in substandard housing. She was talking about the look in people's eyes. She was talking about the fact that the United States and the rest of the world as well, but we've kind of led the charge on this. We have accomplished an incredible achievement in our lifetime. We have found a way to be both stuffed and empty at the same time. We found a way to be both stuffed and hollow at the same time. And you wonder why that is. Well, it's because contentment is not only not conditional, but contentment is spiritual. It's a spiritual issue. There are very real dark forces in this world who want us to be anything but content with who we are and what God has for us. There are very real dark forces at work in this world that want us to be focused on anything but who God created us to be. And if you could just get us to focus for 40, 50, 60, 70, 80 years on who everybody else is becoming around us, it wins. Contentment is a spiritual issue. That's why we can't understand it. That's why it seems so countercultural that more stuff wouldn't make us happier. Of course it would. It might not make them more happy, but give it to me and it would make me more happy. Why can we not understand that gap? It's because it's not something we can put our hands on. It's a spiritual thing. And I want to be careful as we're working through this in November. I want to be careful. We are not going to be talking about these irrational, crazy American consumers out there. We're going to be talking about these irrational, crazy American consumers in here. This is us. We are all drinking from poisoned water on this. And we get so caught up in the rhythm of it on a daily basis that we don't recognize it. And I know for me, it's a constant journey for me and a constant struggle on this where I've found some growth on this, but I have to be constantly, vigilantly aware of this. I think the first time for me that it really, really popped up, really kind of in a huge way that I really saw it face to face was, about 14 years ago. Nancy and I were newly married and I had kind of a unique opportunity come my way. I was still working at P&G at the time and we had purchased a company on the East Coast and we're going to be moving, the brands from that company back to Cincinnati. And they asked me if I would go with a few other managers out to Connecticut to help for about 6 months manage those brands and then manage their transition back to Cincinnati. And Nancy and I were newly married. We didn't have any kids. And it was going to be kind of a nice area for the summer that we were going to. So we said, well, we'll check this out. We'll see. So got on a plane and we went out there and a realtor showed us around. And one of the nice things was about this deal was because it was a temporary thing, P&G was going to be picking up all our expenses while we were there, renting the place for us, anything we needed, picking up all that. So realtor took around us for the day and showed us some different summer homes that we might build to rent, apartments while we were out there. And we came back and, well, there's a couple that I think will work. So we decided to do it. But then something strange happened. I made the mistake of having lunch with a few other managers who were also going out there. And it seemed like we all hadn't cut quite the same deal. Or my friend Rob, who was also going to be going out there doing the same thing I was, he revealed to me that he'd been able to score a beachside cottage with a windsurfer and a jacuzzi. Somebody else at lunch mentioned that, you know, we got to come back to Cincinnati every other weekend. They mentioned that they had negotiated that they didn't have to fly commercial on the way back. They were going to be flying one of the company planes back and forth every other weekend. Well, Suddenly this became a high stakes poker game, you know, with a company expense account as the chips we were playing. So it was Allison and I looked at that slum, that shack that we had decided to rent, and it was, this is unacceptable. How could I live for the summer on the East Coast and not be, you know, on the waterfront? You know, how could this happen? How could I have agreed to fly coach? I'm going to fly coach back and forth. I got to nip this in the bud. Who knows where this thing will go? Maybe domestic Chardonnay is next. I don't know. You know, need to deal with this. So I went back and kind of, you know, expressed some of my displeasure and reworked some stuff and was able to do, okay, well, you can use the company, you can get on the company plane every other weekend and that. And I wasn't able to get a beachfront cottage, but I was able to score a harborfront condo that had my own boat slip, you know, right outside the door. Didn't have a boat. But I had a boat slip. And every morning I walked out and I looked at that boat slip. I said, if I had a boat, it would be right here. It would be right here. You know, we hear that and we think, well, that, you know, that's kind of like an extreme kind of situation, you know. I think more often than not, if we look at the kinds of things that are influencing our decisions that we're making, more often than not, we'd realize our contentment is not so much related to, what we've got, but it's related relative terms to what people around us have. How many of you, when you think about it, you say, yeah, there's been at least one significant decision in my life that has come into play, you know, that I've had to wrestle. Yeah. Well, you know, those of you that have your hands up, you know, during this series, you know, realize you might have an issue with contentment, you know, to work on. Everybody that didn't raise your hands, you probably have an issue with honesty. And, we'll get to that in a later series, okay? We're gonna get to you, so just hold on. Alright? Just pray for everyone else around you on this one. We don't realize this because it is a spiritual issue. And at some point, I really came to wrestle with this. And I really felt, at that time, I felt what God really was saying to me was that, you know, Brian, I don't want you to think that I'm disappointed in you because it takes too much to satisfy you. Brian, I want you to know I'm sad because it takes too little. You settle for too little. I have this life that I've designed you for, and you're settling for these little scraps and these little crumbs and more crumbs, and you think that's going to do it, and you're missing the life that I have for you. You're missing joy. You're missing fulfillment. You're missing what contentment really is. It's not that you want too much. It's that you settle for too little. And so a big part of my journey on this, it really impacted me over the last 15 years, has been studying the writings of Paul. That have been collected in our Bible. Saying the writings of Paul, this guy who came to amazing places in understanding contentment. So much so that for me, and again, you know, I am not the poster child for contentment by any means, but so much so, picture that guy totally bummed out and renegotiating the condo deal in Connecticut to, you know, a few years later of kind of wrestling through what does Paul's writings really mean for me, of coming to the place that we were going to start Crossroads, I was able to take a 65% pay cut and walk away from all that to do this. Somewhere in that gap and on that journey, I found that contentment was not related to my conditions, what either I have or those around me have. And again, it's still a constant journey for me. What I want to spend the rest of this morning doing is sharing with you a little bit of Paul's learnings on this that could contribute as we spend the month of November really trying to recalibrate and finding the life that God has for us. I think the most first thing that's really important before we really look at some of the stuff that Paul wrote is to understand who this Paul was that was writing these things. I mean, when he said radical things like, I've learned the secret of contentment and it has nothing to do with whether I'm in need or I'm not, whether I have food or I don't. This was not a guy who was referring to, I've learned to be content whether I get that big promotion or not. You know, I've learned to be content whether I'm able to add on to my house or not. This was a guy who really knew the extremes of what it meant to have or not. This is a guy that started out in his life with a lot of resources and in a position of key power and influence with a lot of resources and connections at his disposal. And this was a guy that after he became a follower of Christ faced the other end of it and had stripped away from him and even found himself often in prison and being tortured because of the message of Jesus Christ. This is a Roman citizen who went from both extremes. And so when he's talking about learning the secret of contentment, even when he's in want, this is a little idea of what he's talking about. This is a place in another letter that he wrote to an area of Corinth. And this is an area I like to call kind of Paul's pain resume. Okay? Here's what he says. Five times I've received from the Jews 40 lashes minus one. Now, as a Roman citizen, it was illegal. They had limits on how much you could torture a Roman citizen. The most could be 39 lashes. So five times he was captured and they gave him the absolute most they could give anybody, which is 39 lashes. Five times I received from the Jews 40 lashes minus one. Three times I was beaten with rods. Once I was stoned. Three times I was shipwrecked. I spent a night and a day in the open sea. I've been constantly on the move. I've been in danger from rivers, in danger from bandits, in danger from my own countrymen, danger from Gentiles, in danger at sea, and in danger from false brothers. I've labored and toiled and have gone without sleep. I've known hunger and thirst and have often gone without food. I've been cold and naked. This is the guy who's speaking these words about contentment. This is the guy who a lot of these words that we've read that he wrote about these things were written while his hands were manacled together in prison. This is a guy who's not treating it lightly when he talks about being in need. And it's the same guy who says this, back to Philippians again. In all of this, I've learned to be content. I know what it is to be in need. Remember how what he's talking about need there. And I know what it is to have plenty. You know, the interesting thing is here, he says also, I know what it is to have plenty. That he's also learned the secret of being content when he has plenty. You know, there's nowhere in the Bible that you're condemned for having plenty. There's nowhere in the Bible where you're to feel shameful because you're blessed with an enormous amount of resources. Paul said, I've been able to find contentment in that as well. But he says the secret here is that it's unrelated to these situations, whether I have a lot or little. And he says, I've learned the secret of being content. What's also interesting is the verb that he uses here. Because when Paul says, I've learned the secret, he's using a very interesting verb there that was mostly used during his time. Most often used to describe, there were a lot of these secret societies at his time. These small religious cults, these mysterious cults with all these secrets. And when you were initiated into one of them, when you became an enemy, you were revealed these secrets to you. And that's the verb that he's using. That's the very same verb that I've uncovered these secrets and it's been revealed to me. And what Paul seems to be saying here is that we need to understand that contentment does not come natural. The default of this world is not contentment. You will not, by pursuing the normal path that this world has for you, find contentment. It is something you have to be aggressively engaged in pursuing. There is a secret of contentment that we need to uncover. And we find that through a very aggressive engagement on discovering what this means. And so for me, Paul's writings have really influenced what I've learned in the last 15 years about this. And the first one that I think is kind of most appropriate for us in here today is we have to learn to recognize our influences. You need to learn to recognize your influences. And we all have these influencers. I volunteer every once in a while at my kid's school. And if you've ever been on a playground with small kids, you've seen that there are a couple kids that are influencers on each playground. There's a couple kids that if they play kickball, other people are going to want to play kickball. You know, if they go to the slides, other kids are going to want to go to the slides. And we've all had that. We've all had that growing up, somebody who influenced us like that. It might have changed from year to year. But I think we operate under this false belief that now that we're kind of mature, functioning adults, we've kind of left all that behind on the playground. And the fact is, we haven't. We all still have these influencers. We all still have these relationships that influence us and can taint our understanding of contentment and satisfaction. You know, for a lot of us as adults, you know what the key relationship is that does this for us? Advertising. Advertising is a key relationship of influence that we have on our life. And, you know, it's not, I'm not saying that all advertising is bad by any means. You know, I did it for 10 years. It's what I studied in school. Advertising can be a very helpful communication tool to help us understand things are available and things that can meet our needs. Advertising is inherently a neutral tool. The challenge for us, though, that it isn't about the last 20 years or so, advertisers have really developed this place of really trying to develop relationships with consumers. And, you know, for some good reasons, it's not inherently bad, but one of the things that can fall through this kind of relationship marketing is if we can start to operate under the misassumption that advertising is our friend. You know what? I have a lot of advertisers who are my friends. I have no advertising that's my friend. But yet we tend to think we don't analyze, we don't stop and recognize our influences, analyze these messages that are coming to me. I need to filter them because they might not be appropriate for me right now, or they might be scratching an unhealthy itch for me. But we can fall into thinking that, well, this is just kind of this information come to me from a trusted friend. You know what? If you think advertising is your friend, here's what you do. The next time you need to move, pick up that bottle and call the 800 number on the back. You know, see if you can get some help moving, or at least they'll bring some boxes over for you, you know? Advertising is not our friend. We need to be discerning about it. It's not inherently bad, but we need to be discerning about what it's doing to our choices. So for instance, you know, this is kind of a little bit of my old stomping grounds. I used to work in hair care, and one of the most successful brands at P&G in hair care, global brands, is Pantene. Pantene, and it's a great product. It's a wonderful product. And you know, what they've learned is that consumers, particularly women, tend to think that their hair can be in different stages of health or not, even though kind of hair is a dead thing. It can be in different stages of health. And one of the signs of health is does it shine? How shiny is it? So Pantene's learned, you know, that this is a key promise for the technology they developed, is that, you know, your hair will be so healthy that it'll shine. And so all Pantene ads will have these killer visuals of really, really shiny hair. Nothing wrong with that. Nothing inherently bad with you wanting to have shiny hair or finding a product that delivers it. I can tell you, though, we need to be discerning and recognize our influences, though, because if the quality of your day or your self-esteem is influenced by how well your hair happens to reflect light that day, you're not recognizing your influencers. And if that's impacting how you feel about yourself, something's wrong. Now, what's interesting is for guys, they've kind of learned that, you know, guys don't kind of appreciate all these subtleties quite as much as women do. They're not kind of quite as nuanced. So, you know, guys' advertising looks a little bit more like this. Yeah, they just, you know, kind of get right to it, you know? You know what? I've been in enough focus groups and brainstorming. I know how this came about. I know they said, well, you know what? When's the most time where, you know, most vodka is consumed? Well, it's martinis. And so when guys go to a bar, what do they want to do? They want to meet women, you know, for the most part. So, hey, what? I know. Let's develop an ad where a guy's at a bar ordering a martini and then there's this hot woman in the background. You know, and they took that and they focus grouped it. And the guys were like, yeah, whatever. And they're like, they're just not getting it. And at some point, somebody said, you know what I think we're going to have to do? We're going to have to actually put the woman in the martini glass. You know, if we put her in there, I think it'll connect the dots for him. You know, and we constantly have these influences coming at us, and they're not inherently bad. We just need to filter them and realize that we need to calibrate them against what's healthy for our choices and why are we making the choices that we are. So that it might be entirely wonderful for you to buy that new set of Nike golf clubs. It might be a wonderful thing that you have, but you need to be able to at least recognize your influencers enough to stop right before you hand them that credit card and say to yourself, I know that buying these clubs is not going to help me play golf even one bit better. Because that's what studies show. You know, they just don't. Buying new clubs is not going to do it. Now, if I want to buy them because I enjoy them, you know, that's fine. And if I can afford that, you know, that's fine. But I need to recognize my influencers. Or, you know, for a woman saying, you know, just might be that a big part of Uma Thurman's appeal is not that wristwatch she's wearing in the ad. You know, there might be other stuff at play here. Or, you know, Bono. You know, God bless him. I have a great respect for him, and he's doing a lot of great things in the world. He's a real hero. At the same time, I need to realize when Bono is speaking, he's also talking to me as an iPod salesman. And I need to realize that. I need to recognize my influencers. And see, the problem is, when we don't recognize these influencers and recalibrate them, we end up on this constant hedonic treadmill of just saying, okay, well, then that must be it. That must be why I'm not happy. You know, then it must be this, and it must be this. And we end up in this constant pursuit. And it's supposed to be these things like logic and reason of being able to pick apart these messages that are one of the things that are supposed to separate us as humans from the rest of the animals. You know, I wonder about that. You know, I've had a dog for about a year now, and I'm starting to question more and more just how much different we really are, or not, you know, than other animals. You know, I talked about, you know, about a year ago, Nancy and I were wanting to get a dog, and we ended up, somebody gave us a dog. Yeah, that's Moose. That is Moose. Awesome. Awesome blessing to our family. And everybody has that reaction when they see Moose and he's at the party. They're like, oh, he's so cute. And they'll say, does he bite? Can I pet him? I'm like, no, he doesn't bite. Fine, you can pet him. They love to pet him and nuzzle him. And as they are saying, yeah, he doesn't bite. You do need to know he's, what's the word? A poop eater. Yeah. You kind of need to know that. That kind of is. Now, we're not going to judge him. All right. We've all got our stuff. We've all got our stuff we're working on. He just happens to eat his, okay? It's where he is at the moment, okay? It's where he is. He's working through some stuff. Working through some stuff, and I'm there for him. But one of the things about Moose, he loves to do, I didn't realize when I got him that a retriever, there's a reason for them being called retrievers. He loves to fetch stuff, loves to fetch stuff. So he has a couple things, you know, that he kind of loves there. Here's where, you know, one of his favorite, you know, ball and a stick. And so we'll go out, and he could spend a half hour, he could spend an hour doing this. And, you know, I'll go out, I'll take the tennis ball to the park, or go out with him, and we'll play fetch, and I'll throw it, but I realize he's big on the retrieving, he's not so big on the releasing of the ball. So he hasn't quite caught on that I can't throw it again if he doesn't release the ball. You know, but I found this little trick that I can do with him. When we're out playing catch, I'll throw the ball, and he'll go get it, and in between the time he's getting it and he comes back, I'll look around, I'll forage, and I'll find a stick. When he comes back, he'll have the ball, and he'll be all happy and totally psyched that he has this ball, and I'll hold up the stick. I'll say, "Hey, Moose, what are you doing with that ball? Ball, settle for that, but look, I've got a stick. The stick is what you really want. The stick is going to make you happy." He just starts going crazy for the stick. Crazy for the stick, starts jumping up, drops the ball, and he just wants the stick. He knows the stick is the deal. So then I throw the stick. He goes and gets the stick, and then he brings it back. And then what? I'm standing there with the ball. "Moose, what are you settling for the stick? The ball's why we came out here. The ball's the deal. You want the ball. The ball's going to make you happy. This is where it continues." And sure enough, he drops the stick, and he wants the ball. I throw the ball. Goes to get the ball, comes back for the stick. This goes on and on. Stick and ball. For a half hour, an hour, he will do this. And, you know, you think at some point he might pause on one of his trips back, and he might say, "You know, this ball isn't really bringing me the happiness or real inner fulfillment that I thought it was going to. You know, I don't feel any more content now with this ball than when I had that stick a minute ago. And now I'm getting ready to drop the ball and go for the stick again. Something's kind of missing here. You know, I actually wonder if maybe this whole thing is just a diversion ploy from that big pile of poop and retriever just left over there." You know, you would think he would start kind of questioning some of this. But he doesn't. You know what? We live in a world that is defined by chasing after the stick and the ball. We live in a world where swirling around us are all these messages from the Joneses and from everyone else, and we become the Joneses for other people as well, that is all about the stick and the ball. I've got the ball. Oh, no, now what I really want. That didn't do it. What's really going to help make me happy is that stick. And then we get the stick, and then, what I want is the ball. What I really want is the ball. And then we go for that. And then we end up when we say, "Okay, well, you know, I've got the stick, but, you know, maybe if I refinance the stick and I add it onto the stick, that would do it. Or, you know, now I've got the ball. Oh, man, how can I get out of this lease on this ball so I can trade up for a better ball?" Constantly, stick and ball. And we don't even see it. It sounds funny, but it's absolutely true. It sounds funny because our entire world, particularly here in the U.S., has become defined by this. This really struck me. I talked about this right after 9/11. You know, if any of you are students of U.S. history, you know that whenever the United States has gone through kind of a tough period, whether it be a war or another downtime, there's always this way that people rally together. And there's all these kind of rallying cry to conserve resources. That we need to conserve resources, you know, in a lot of cases, for the war effort. It's where the term wartime economy came from. We're in a wartime economy. What does that mean? Oh, well, we conserve resources. We spend less. We consume less. So much so that during World War II, if you went out on the highways, there would be billboards. And the billboards would say, "Is this trip necessary?" And it wasn't saying everybody needs to stop driving. It was saying, just ask yourself, is this trip necessary? And if it's not, we might be better served by you not burning that gas and we conserving it for the war effort because we need gas and we need oil. So this kind of, this attitude, this wartime economy attitude of conserving. And then it really struck me when 9/11 hit. You know, right after 9/11, what were the messages that we heard? Well, we heard, you know what? We haven't quite figured this out, but we are at war. And somewhere or the other, things have changed, and we are in a warlike state here. So prepare, get ready. Get ready. Things have changed. We're in a new place, and this is war. And then how many of us went out on the highways, and in response to this, we saw these signs that said, "Is this trip necessary?" No, they weren't. We did see signs, though, on the highway. And what did they say? Keep America rolling. And there were these huge deals between the government and automakers and our economy. Keep America rolling. Here's some low-cost financing. Here's some way. The whole message was, you know what? We need to fight back. We need to keep this economy going. Even though, and these were people on both sides of the political aisle, even though that people are absolutely being destroyed by credit card debt, and debt is, they're up to their eyeballs, and it's destroying families, it's destroying people, their message was, don't stop spending. We've got to keep America rolling. It's like some big card game where we're bluffing and we've just got to keep upping the ante. And please, nobody put their credit cards away now. We've got to keep America rolling. And so what we learned was it's actually true that when the going gets tough, the tough really do go shopping. Apparently that's, you know, what we do. So we, you know, got to keep America rolling. So, oh, boy, we're at war. We're under attack. I got to get out the credit card. You know what? I'll take those Armani pants and the matching jacket. Take that, Osama. Yeah, see, they mess with us. We'll show him. And you know what? It's not just an American thing. This is a world thing. This is a kingdom of this world thing. These are the systems of this world. Because the problem is, the systems of this world have yet to find a way that they can cash a check based on your contentment. The systems of the world, we need to constantly be filtering and understanding that the message to us is to jump back on this treadmill. And you know what? It's not a win for the series that we all consume less. You know, I think there would be great things for our environment, great things for future generations if we consumed less. But that's not the value that we're lifting up here. The value that we're lifting up is the fact in whatever you have, if it's not making you happy, you need to realize that that gap between what you have and what you think you want is a spiritual vacuum. It is a God-shaped hole. And spiritual vacuums are never filled by physical stuff. There's this vacuum. And one of the ways we recognize that this is a spiritual issue, not a conditional issue, is that we purposely practice restraint. And I do mean practice because it doesn't come easy. We practice restraint. And just to let you know what restraint means in this case is that we have how much we can spend. And where we are right now is we have how much we can spend, and then on the other side of it is how much we're spending. And we're spending more than we really can. Restraint is not bringing that back in line so we're spending what we can. Restraint is spending less than we can. On purpose. And realizing that in that gap between what I can spend and what I do spend, and that emptiness I feel, in that gap is a spiritual growth opportunity God has for me. And realizing that that's the place where God meets us is in that gap. Because if we don't, one of the consequences of this, one of the collateral damage that this hedonic treadmill does to us is an erosion of community. And so we can end up saying, wow, I've got the house with the square footage, I've got the stuff, I've got the job, all this, but why do so many of us have all those things, but yet we feel this nebulous feeling that something's been stolen from us and we're not quite sure what it is? It's because for most of us, it's relationships. We do not have any real relationships, real friendships. And we fail to connect the dots because that's collateral damage from the hedonic treadmill. Because what happens is you cannot pursue real relationships with people you're using as a scorecard. You cannot be both completely open with someone relationally and be comparing yourself with them and constantly trying to measure up. It's something that it really struck me the way my wife put it a couple years ago. One of the things I think my wife is she's a very good friend, very good friends to friends that she had. And we were talking about this one day, and this is what she said, and I've always remembered this. She said, you know what the problem is? We use relationships to compare our lives instead of share our lives. God never intended relationships to be used for that purpose. So we're grabbing the screwdriver, and we're trying to use it like a wrench, and we're wondering why it's not working. This comparison thing, we will never have real relationships as long as these people are a scorecard for us. And this is one of the things that Paul really struck on. In another place, when he's writing to the church at Corinth again, he's talking about these one people that are having real trouble in that community in Corinth. And here's how he describes the situation and what their problem is. He says, their trouble is that they're only comparing themselves with each other. And this thing of comparison. that until we get to a place where we're using relationships actually to share our lives instead of compare our lives, we will never find these pieces of fulfillment that God has for us. So we recognize our influencers and we practice restraint. There's kind of one more though that I think is absolutely critical, that's a learning that Paul had that's meant so much for my life and trying to apply it, even in very clumsy ways, is that we have to find some regular rhythm that helps us recalibrate to reality. Because the fact is, we have to recognize that our Joneses does not represent reality. In one way they don't. For instance, most of us, the Joneses for us are not the people next door. The Joneses for us are maybe the house next door, but it's the car across the street. It's the people the block over with the boat. It's these people down here and their kids. It's this composite image we put together of the best of all these things. And then that becomes our Jones that we're comparing ourselves. It's this phantom comparison that doesn't really exist. The other way we have to realize is that we don't live in reality is just the sheer numbers of we need to find some constant way to recalibrate and appreciate the numbers. The numbers that say that every single person in here, wherever you are economically today, every single person in here is better off than 94% of the people who ever walked our planet. That every single person, that if you go home today to clean drinking water and more than one pair of shoes, you are way ahead of the curve for the rest of the world. As you find yourself in any of those places, you realize, hear it very clearly, and this is with no exaggeration, you are rich. You are rich. And vast, vast majority of us in here are somewhere in between the top 12% and the top 5% of wealth in the entire world. But yet so much of our discontentment and so much of our stress is, oh God, I'm in the top 11%, but look what I could have if I was in the top 10%. And it's not reality, and we need to find healthy ways to constantly recalibrate. And the main way we do is to expose ourselves, to find ourselves continually exposing to where, you know, turn this comparison thing the other way and compare ourselves in a realistic way to the rest of the world. And out of that comes this thing, this strange thing that the month of November used to be known for. Gratitude. Out of that comes Thanksgiving. Remember Thanksgiving? The holiday formerly known as Thanksgiving? You know, and now it's the day before, the day after where you shop for Christmas. Thanksgiving, that's what this is created as a time where as the harvest is coming in, people are realizing we've lived another year and we can be thankful for that. And Paul talks about that this time in a letter that he's writing to Thessalonica here. And he says, the deal is we need to learn to give thanks in all circumstances. For this is God's will for you in Christ Jesus. And remember, he's writing a lot of these things and his hands are in shackles and he's been beaten and he's imprisoned. And he's saying he doesn't give thanks for all circumstances. He can give thanks in all circumstances. Because when we recalibrate, we realize that just the sheer air we're breathing is a gift that not everyone is benefiting from today. And one of the other ways that gratitude, constantly recalibrating through gratitude, is it comes out through our giving. It comes out through this healthy exercise. There is nothing more that will attack this dark message that more is the answer than taking some of what you have and giving it away. You will never find more spiritual lessons than in that activity. And so, you know, in these next 4 weeks, I just want you to stay open to what recalibration means. Stay open that maybe what you're viewing and what you're feeling is not reality. Because the thing is, this is it for us. I'm convinced that in the year 2006 in Cincinnati, this is the defining spiritual issue that's keeping people from the life God has for them. Both people who call themselves followers of Christ and people who don't. It's this issue. And so the question is during the series, what is it for you? What is in that gap? Is it, oh, well, just $10,000 more? Or is it if I could just get to that office two doors down? Or is it if I could just get this car? Or is it if I could just get married? Or is it if we could just have kids? Whatever it is, you need to realize, and you may end up having those things, but you need to realize that gap is a precious, precious thing. That is the place where God meets you. That gap is the space where God pursues you. And God tells you, drop the stick. Drop the ball. You need to know that if you're living a life that's defined by chasing after that stick and chasing after that ball, you are living a cursed life. You are living under a curse and you will never find fulfillment. You're living under a curse of low expectations. God says, you don't need to feel shame that it's too hard to satisfy you. You need to feel sad that it's too easy. I've got so much more for you. And the sticks and the balls, they may still come. But we need to understand that growth and life come in the gap. That's where we find God. Let me pray. God, we ask that you would... I don't ask that those gaps be taken away, even in my own life. God, I ask that we can see you and experience you more clearer in those gaps. And there we can find contentment. And we pray that this would spill over to our families and our friends and our community and our world. In Jesus' name, amen.